Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay.
The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the Supreme Court pronounced this day are posted in the clerk's office and available for inspection. There will be three causes submitted on our oral docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Vort Exploration Company, Incorporated versus Chevron USA, Incorporated from Young County. H.S. Gus Edwards and others from versus Lone Star Gas Company from Cottle County. And Tommy Thompson versus the Travelers Indemnity Company of Rhode Island from Travis County. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being presented, but we ask that you remain nearby. Counsel in all causes are notified that we are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to these at some later time, you may make application with the clerk's office to listen to those tapes. The court is pleased to welcome two groups of students who are here to hear in the courtroom for our first argument. One group is from Millsap High School and the other group is from Richardson Pierce High School. We welcome you to the Supreme Court. We are now ready to hear oral arguments in the first cause. In this matter, the petitioner will be allotted 20 minutes to present oral argument, the respondent will be allotted 20 minutes, and the petitioner will have 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Duncan, also will present argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, as noted by the marshal, my name is Duncan Goff of the law firm of Goff and Goff in Middle West, Texas, and we represent the petitioner, Vort Exploration Company, which will be hereinafter referred to as Vort. The respondent in this matter is Chevron USA, which will be referred to as Chevron, and is formerly known as Gulf Oil Corporation. As noted previously, this suit arises out of a dispute in Young County, Texas, and it is a suit in quantum merit, wherein the district court of Young County, Texas, awarded Vort a money judgment in the amount of some $178,750 for services rendered in providing confidential and valuable seismic geological data in connection with the drilling of a well that was completed by Chevron in November of 1983. The well has become a enormously profitable well. As of the day of the trial in January 1987, some 55,000 barrels of oil had been produced. And as of that, the estimated reserves were some 150,000. So we're talking about a total of something over 200,000 barrels of oil. The court below, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, centered its opinion in reversing and rendering the judgment of the District Court of Young County, Texas, on element number 4 on quantum merit, as has been previously outlined by this court in the Bashara case. And as the court here well knows, that element number 4, which has been enumerated by this court on other occasions as well, said that the plaintiff claiming recovery in quantum merit must show that under such circumstances there was reasonable notification that the person sought to be charged that the plaintiff in performing or providing such services or good was expecting to be paid by the person sought to be charged. Now applying that element, the Fort Worth court made two statements which are the focal point of this appeal. At the bottom of page 7 of the opinion by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, there is this statement which petitioner asserts is error, that there is no evidence that Chevron was notified that Vort in performing such services and assistance expected a quid pro quo of joining in a mutually satisfactory agreement for joint production of oil and gas on the tract. The second statement, which is the focal point of our appeal, is found at the bottom of page 8 of the court's opinion, wherein the Fort Worth Court of Appeals makes this statement. There's no evidence that Bork provided the seismic information, graphs, and maps under circumstances that reasonably notified Chevron that Bork expected payment if a mutually satisfactory operating agreement was not reached. The application for writ of error was granted on points 1, 2, 4, and 5. Point 1 dealing with the finding of the Fort Worth court to the effect that there was no evidence of any quid pro quo of joining in a mutually satisfactory operating agreement. We submit and plead the court that that finding is gravely in error, and in that connection, we invite the court's attention to a number of facts which are set out in the petitioner's application for writ of error and in the findings of fact made by the trial court. The trial court found that Bork provided these services and assistance to Chevron in the belief that Chevron and Bork would jointly develop the subject 160 acres for the production of oil and gas, and but for such relief, would not have provided such services and assistance to Chevron, which were undertaken for both Chevron and Bork.
Why, counsel, does that not equate to that Bork had an expectation of being named the operator? And this is why he was providing this information to Chevron.
Yes, it is Bork's intention that it in good faith believed that there would be a joint development of the tract.
He was trying to induce Chevron to get him named as operator.
There was a continuing dispute, Your Honor, as to who would be the operator from the very outset. Bork wanted to be the operator and Chevron wanted to be the operator. The initial agreement in principle, which was testified to by Mr. H. Carl Vandenbort, president of Bork, was to the effect that he had an understanding and an agreement with Chevron that there would be a joint development of the 160-acre tract for the production of oil and gas.
Was that an oral agreement?
It was oral, but there was also some correspondence that related to that. For example, the initial letter from Bork to Gov, as it was then, on March of 1979, letter signed by Vandenbort, saying that I believe it would be, we could agree that whereby Gov and Bork would each wind up with one half of the working interest, and so we'll work this out together. And then later on, after an abstract was obtained, Mr. R.E. Griffith, who is the land manager for Gulf, Chevron is now, a letter of October 31st, 1979, wrote to Bork, enclosing a title opinion that their attorney had provided, and said this, this is an exact quote, upon the satisfaction of all requirements found therein, we will work out an operating agreement.
Is there any written evidence of a meeting of the minds, though, on the operating agreement?
Only evidence was the agreement in principle that they would develop together. The percentages were never agreed upon.
There was an agreement to agree later.
It was an agreement to develop the property, but the percentages were never agreed upon. And there were other details that were never agreed upon, namely who would be the operator and authorization for expenses and other matters with respect to the various proposed operating agreements. During this period of time from 1979 to 1980, three, in that framework, there were a number of proposed operating agreements submitted back and forth with relative to percentages, with 65% for Chevron, 35% for Boynton, one was 50-50. There was some dispute over a clause whereby a party contributing the lease had to bear alone the cost of any of the loss of that lease, even though the parties might otherwise have 100% of the minerals lease. And this first title opinion here, and referred to in this letter 79, opposing counsel has made a statement in his brief to the effect that the title opinion had concluded that some receiver's leases held by Board, which covered some 58% of the minerals, were determined by that title opinion to be invalid. We disagree with that statement of counsel. We believe it's an error because in the title opinion itself, the language from the attorney for Chevron said that he understood that Boynton would be willing to release those leases. Then he added, under such circumstances, we are not furnishing any analysis with respect to the validity of the receiver's lease or whether or not it could be set aside. To back up just a moment, at the very outset, in 1979, Bort stated in a letter to Chevron that the title was badly broken up, and it attached the schedule of its computations as to what percentage of minerals were leased by Bort, what percentage were leased by Goff, and what percentage was under the Young County receivership, that is the lease that had been obtained in 1978 by order of the District Court of Young County, Texas. Roughly, those figures amounted to 35% for Ward, 39% for Chevron, with the receiver's lease shown at some 57%. The dispute over the validity of the receiver's lease and what to do about that was one of the reasons why the parties could never reach an agreement. I don't know what I
think. Did the parties never reach an agreement?
They never reached an agreement as to a division of the working interest. So what happened was that through inadvertence, Board allowed some of its leases to expire, and in the meantime, when that happened, Chevron had gone ahead and gotten top leases and then proceeded to go forward in November of 1983 with the actual drilling. Bort did not know about this omission on his part until after this lawsuit was filed. There was also at that time the issue of what we call Callahan leases, which were further and additional leases which were obtained by Bort and which Bort tendered to Chevron in an effort to try to work out a joint agreement 50-50 along with the receiver's lease. It would not be a fair statement to say, as the brief response of Chevron has said here, to suggest that it was only the Callahan leases involved. There were a lot more other things that prevented or that resulted in the parties not being able to reach an agreement.
You supplied the information voluntarily, is that true?
Yes, sir. On the belief, though, as is testified to by the president, that there had been an agreement.
You just said there wasn't an agreement. You didn't agree upon any of the details of an operating.
They agreed to jointly develop in principle the tract in question, but the percentages were never finalized.
Well, the operator wasn't finalized. The percentage of who owned what, who was going to bear the risk of loss of title was not agreed to. What did you agree to?
That they would jointly develop the property. In fact, Mr.
There's Griffin gun there on that. Do you have an agreement to develop, jointly develop the property in writing?
No, sir.
I understood your cause of action to be in quantum merit, not on the contract. Is that correct?
The action is in quantum merit.
Yeah, so you're not trying to prove a contract, an enforceable contract existed, but simply that work was done on the expectation that they'd be paid for.
That is correct, Your Honor. Exactly.
That's a different question.
Maybe I haven't made it clear, but this work was all done on the belief and on the basis of Ward insisting and saying we have entered into an agreement to jointly develop the property. And therefore, this highly confidential and very valuable information was then furnished, relying on that agreement. The parties were never able, however, to define the exact percentages. But that does not in any way take away from the fact that this was highly valuable information that could not have been otherwise obtained by Chevron. In fact, the trial court so found the drill site of this well, the Kaiser well, was in the exact spot, to the foot that was shown by the highly confidential seismic geological data and maps provided by Board to Chevron.
So you're saying that Chevron took the information.
They took the information
and used it. And then denied any agreement.
Yes, so the trial court found that they took the information and used it.
Took it or received it? I mean, didn't you offer it to them?
It was offered to them in the spirit of going forward with a joint development, and it was offered there in the office of this Mr. Griffin, the land manager, and he had some of his subordinates there at the time to look it over, and it was updated from time to time. In other words, the information was furnished beginning or in July of 1981 and in years prior there too.
Did they trick you or encourage you to give it to you? No claim of that.
The president of Gore said they hornswoggled me and they got my highly confidential seismic data and highly confidential logs, and they used them because we had wells in the immediate vicinity. They never could have got it otherwise, and I gave it to them believing that we were going to work together.
Did he believe that he had an agreement to join the development?
Yes.
Do you have any evidence of that, any written evidence of an agreement to join the development?
There is only over above what I previously related to the court, there is a statement of Mr. Griffin in reference to a meeting in January of 81 saying that we had a meeting for the purpose of agreeing on who owned what and for jointly developing the property.
Well, they met.
I'll get the exact quotation.
They met for that purpose. Did they accomplish that purpose at that meeting?
No, sir. The negotiations continued. And in the fall of that year, 1981, Bart drilled a shallow gas well for the purpose of trying to preserve its receiver's leases, and then following that, failed to pay the shut-in gas oil. I note that opposing counsel has referred to the Truly Austin case, in which this court pointed out in reference to quantum merit that there must be some showing of unjust enrichment, and the trial court found in this instance in favor of Bort that non-payment to Bort would result in unjust enrichment. Going now to the other questions that we have here on points 2, 3, and 4, it seems, Your Honor, that the court of appeal to Fort Worth is making the additional requirement that Bort would have to show that it would have to expect payment if the operating agreement or if the agreement for joint development was not consummated. We think that's an additional requirement that doesn't exist in the quantum merit cases. The court, as we see it, impliedly holds that the expectation of entering into operating agreement is not a sufficient expectation. They expect that the payment may not be in that form. But there are any number of cases cited here in the application wherein things other than money have formed the basis of quantum merit actions before this court here. The Scott case, which involved the devise of real property, an oral, unenforceable oral agreement, and there was a recovery in quantum merit. And again, before this court in the Campbell case, again, an unenforceable agreement because of the statute of frauds where there was an option to purchase an apartment complex. At least that's what the petitioner thought he had. And then in other jurisdictions, we have cases here, one involving a rather interesting Florida case where there was an expectation of marriage and where the would-be husband performed a lot of services in getting a hotel on its feet. The marriage plan fell through. What just happened? It's a matter of restitution. There are other cases as well cited here. One was in reference to an oral agreement with an attorney for a contingent fee of one-third recovery in land. And there the attorney was permitted to recover under quantum merit. So for all those reasons, we respectfully submit that the Court of Appeals at Fort Worth erred and that in reversing and rendering that judgment for the respondent Chevron, and that the judgment of the Court of Appeals at Fort Worth should be reversed and the court should affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you, Governor.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Harris Kerr will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Harris Kerr from Texas, here on behalf of USA Incorporated. I have with me here today my associate Christy Hyde, who had the honor of being sworn in on Monday before the court. Let me take issue with one thing that opposing counsel has said in his argument. He has mentioned the concept of the agreement between the parties, that the parties reached some sort of agreement. As a matter of fact, the trial court found in finding number 11 that the parties failed to reach an agreement. The trial court expressly found that there never was an agreement to jointly develop the property. That finding has never been attacked by Board Exploration. There are some things about this case I believe the court needs to keep in mind in assessing validity of a claim for quantum merit recovery. First, from the onset, these parties were co-tenants. From June of 1979, when Chevron first wrote to the board in reply to a farm-out request, through September of 1983, when Chevron last proposed an operating agreement, Chevron always credited Board with a little more than 35% of the leasehold working interest. Chevron recognized at all times that Board had 35% of the minerals leased under valid leases. Now, during that time period, Board claimed to own vastly different interests under lease. Board initially claimed 93% under its receiver's lease and its other leases. It then claimed an 85% figure. It tried to get to a 50-50 or a 51-49 division. And ultimately, Bort claimed that its chain of title under the Callahans was superior to Gulf's entire chain of title, so that Bort had 100% and Chevron had nothing. That is a dispute that went to trial. Bort claiming under the Callahan leases and claiming 100% of the leasehold estate, and Chevron claiming under the Wyatt chain of title and claiming to the exclusion of Board. Keep in mind also that but for Board failing to pay some shut-in royalties, it would today have 35% of this well, and it never would have risked a penny to drill that well. But for failing to pay those shut-in royalties, it would own 35% of the well. Chevron would have drilled the well and carried its non-consenting co-tenants for 35% of that well. So the fact that Bort doesn't have 35% of that well today is not something Chevron did. It's something Bort did. Bort didn't pay its shut-in royalties. That is absolutely clear. Now there is some conflict in the evidence Mr. Vandervoort testified at one point that it was inadvertent failure to pay those shut-in royalties. Yet at another point, he testified that it was a business decision to rely on the Callahan title and to let those leases lapse. But the evidence is absolutely clear that but for Vort's decision or inadvertence, they would have 35% of this well today.
Did Vort give you that expiration information before or after they didn't renew their lease?
Before, Your Honor. The information was provided, according to the record, starting in 1981. The record indicates that the shut-in royalties were not paid in 1982 or 1983. The record indicates the leases lapsed at the latest in 1983.
But the drilling started after the leases lapsed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And y'all didn't tender back this information that had been given?
I know, Your Honor.
Well, didn't you expect to? Did you expect to pay anything for it, or you expected to just go ahead and use it because they had given it to you?
First, Your Honor, the record contains a lot of evidence by Chevron personnel that they didn't use the evidence. Did not use that material. The
did
evidence
they bring their own crew out there and perform their own seismic work?
They had 1950s geoseismic work that was available as a matter of purchase from a third party. They had geological work. They had information from Railroad Commission, formation, top records. There was a good deal of public information available.
But there is a finding by the trial court on that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there is evidence to support that finding. We're not disputing that finding.
How much was with reference to the shut-in quantities at one trade?
I don't know, Your Honor. It would not be very much money. For example, Your Honor, the bonus paid by Vort for the Callahan leases was $4,000, and I would think it would be somewhat less than that range.
It wouldn't be anywhere near the $18,000 that this information cost to generate allegedly?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it would under the record. That's a point I'd like to address next, the issue of the value of this information relative to its cost. One thing is absolutely clear from this record, that if we are to glean the party's intent about third-party services, we can find one place where they all had the same understanding. There were four operating agreements proposed by the parties to this case. Chevron proposed two and Vort proposed two. Each of those operating agreements has attached to it what is known as an accounting procedure. And each of those accounting procedures contains identical language saying that the joint account may be charged with the cost of third-party services. Not the value, with the cost of third-party services. Now, the seismic information for which Vort seeks recovery, that constitutes work that was done in 1978 for the most part, before Vort ever called Chevron, before Vort ever requested a farmout. Vort owned working interests in the inner half of 2369, the land in this case, and in the surrounding land. Vort, for its own account and for its own benefit, had seismic done on its lease, surrounding, and this east half of 2369. Before they ever contacted Chevron, 95% of this work was done. Before they ever requested a farm out from Chevron, 95% of this work was done for Vort.
What difference does that make?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What difference does that make?
Your Honor, one of the elements of the Bashar case is that the work must be done for the benefit of the party thought to be charged. The record is absolutely clear that this seismic work and the interpretations were obtained by Vort for itself.
Well, but it's the act of furnishing it, not the act of having it done, that seems to me they're suing on it.
I don't think that that's really the issue, Your Honor. I think the fact is that they had this work done for their own benefit at a time when they claimed to own at least 85%.
And to make a deal with Chevron, they said, look, we'll share this with you.
Your Honor, the record doesn't contain anything that says that. The record does not contain a single bit of testimony, not one document, nothing, not even Mr. Vandervoort's testimony where he said, I will give you this seismic in return for anything. There is a devoid record that says that.
Were there any trial court findings pertaining to that?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Were there any trial court findings of fact concerning the reason that Vort spent this $18,000.
I don't believe there is any finding about why Bort spent the $18,000. The record is absolutely clear, though, that there is not a word of testimony by Mr. Vandenborst or any other witness. There is not a single document. There is not anything in evidence in this case whereby Bort said to Chevron, we will contribute our seismic in return for a piece of this well.
Do you think they just did it out of the goodness of their heart? They
no,
want
Your
Chevron
Honor.
To have this information so they could do it. He didn't expect anything in return. You say that that's the simple evidence.
No, Your Honor, I don't say that at all.
Well,
I think that's kind of
a ridiculous position to take, it seems to me. That
no,
they were
sir.
Not furnishing this seismic information with no expectation of making a deal.
Your Honor, keep in mind...
That's what you're saying.
No, sir, that's not what I'm saying. Pardon
Sorry.
Me. Keep in mind that this entire time, Bort owned 35% of the leasehold estate as a co-tenant. Bort would benefit from having a well located where Bort wanted it located. If a well was to be drilled, Bort would benefit from having it located where Bort thought it ought to be located. In the Truly versus Austin case, that was the precise point this court focused on, that the gentleman would benefit from furnishing the services in that case for the joint account. And the court said where that party is going to benefit from the services they claim to provide, there is no quantum merit. That is exactly what is present in this case. Bort Exploration owned 35% of the leasehold estate. They would benefit from the well being located where they want it to be located.
Tell me, if there's no operating agreement, what that 35% amounts to, would have amounted to of the total revenue of the well? I mean, what percent by the time you take out?
They would have been a non-consenting co-tenant, Your Honor. They would have been entitled to 35.3% of the gross revenue of the well after 35.3% of the cost of the well was recovered. The cost of the well was recovered. And they would have had, from that, had to pay whatever royalty burden was on their own interest. But they would have been entitled to 35.3% of the gross revenues less 35.3% of the cost, Your Honor.
But they had already failed to renew that lease before you started drilling, so you knew that they weren't going to get 35% at the time you started drilling?
At the time Chevron started drilling, that is correct, Your Honor. The leases that Chevron took, they took in October of 1983 to cover that 35% interest. However, in September of 1983, Chevron furnished Bort a proposal to join operations, credited Bort with 35.3% of the leasehold estate, and said, let us go forward on this basis. Chevron to operate, you to be credited with 35.3% of the leasehold estate. The parties bear the risk of failure of their own titles. It was only after that proposal was turned down by Bort that Chevron went out and obtained leases on those last unleased interest rights.
Counsel, you've told us that there were four proposals, two made by Bort that Chevron rejected, two made by Chevron that Bort rejected.
That's correct.
That common in all four were that third-party costs were to be shown as cost, not as benefit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What else in common did all four of those agreements have?
A good deal, Your Honor. They were all on a fairly standard form, the standard joint operating agreement form that's used throughout the estate.
Is it fair, then, to say that the differences in the four agreements were they were arguing over percentages of working interest?
There would be two primary differences, Your Honor. One would be the percentages of working interest, and the second would be who bears the risk of failure of title. Chevron was uniform from the beginning that each party bears the risk of failure of title that they contribute. Bort never wanted to rely on its own titles. I think there are two matters of evidence that bring this clear to the court. What exactly was trying to be traded? Bort would now have the court believe that they were trying to trade this seismic information. But as I've said, there is nothing in the record. There's not a single word from Mr. Vandenborst, not a single document, nothing that says we will contribute our seismic in return for. But there is a letter, Plaintiff's Exhibit 76. I think it is prudent to work out something between us since it is rather a difficult title. That's the letter from Mr. Vandenborst to Chevron. And then I think there is another letter from Bort Exploration's attorney to Chevron, dated January 16, 1981, Plaintiff's Exhibit 91. Vort respectfully submits that its contribution of the receiver's lease and the leases covering the Callahan interests is worth at least an additional 15% of the total working interest.
Okay, so as a practical matter, Chevron said that Vort owned 35.3% under his leases.
Yes, sir.
And that Chevron proposed that each party would bear the risk of his title being good for the remainder.
Yes, sir.
So if Boyd had 35.5% going in, if his title stood up, as contrasted to your chain of title, then he'd have another 15%?
That was Boyd's proposal.
That was Boyd's proposal.
That's correct.
So Chevron concedes 35%. Boyd says, no, I'm entitled to that 35 plus another 15 because my title is going to prove superior. Chevron says, no, we think our title is going to be superior, and you're not going to get that 15%. So they were really arguing about a 15% working interest. Isn't that what it amounts to?
At one point, Your Honor, and subsequently, Vort started relying on 100% title to the complete exclusion of Chevron. So at the point in time you're focusing on, that's correct. Vort was trying to swap for a 50-50 deal. They were trying to contribute their receiver leases and Callahan leases in return for an additional 15% of the working interest.
What does the record show about who was going to pay the drilling cost up front? Was Chevron going to do all the drilling, and if they drilled a dry hole, it'd just take a total loss and not look to Vort for any cost of drilling?
Your Honor, under the four operating agreements that were proposed, each party would have paid their proportionate share of all costs. Under the facts as they ended up, Chevron went to drill bearing the entire risk of a dry hole. If in fact there was any validity to any title by Vort, Chevron would have carried all of the risk of that well, and it was ultimately drilled.
Sir, let me ask you, were the seismic logs, excuse me, the seismic data and the electric logs of Vort, were they correct and accurate?
I don't know, Your Honor. They certainly appeared to the trial court to pick the location where the well was drilled. So it is good well. There's no denying that. There's no denying that, Your Honor.
There's been dry hole. We wouldn't have losses, would we?
That's correct, Your
Honor. I'm still a little confused over the chronology. What year was this data presented, and what was the state of the negotiation at the time that Vort was presenting this data?
Your Honor, I'll give you a real quick time rundown. In 1976, Chevron first became interested in the tract and took some leases. Vort first became interested in the tract in 1978 and took leases. In 1978, Vort had all of this seismic work done for itself, for its own benefit. In 1979, Vort contacts Chevron and requests a farm out. Negotiations go back and forth in 1979 and in 1980. The record is pretty clear that these materials were furnished in 1981. Negotiations continued in 1981 and 1982 and in 1983. Negotiations broke down in September of 1983 when Chevron made its last proposal and Vort declined to participate, and Chevron then drilled the well all at its own risk.
And do you agree with your adversary's position that Vort updated that seismic data from 78 up until 83 from time to time?
I don't believe the record really reflects that, Your Honor. I think,
well, that's in dispute.
Yes, sir. I think there may have been additional elevations or some drafting work done, but I don't think there were any additional seismic lines shot. I don't think there's any evidence of that in the record. I would also address the court's attention to plaintiff's exhibit number 2, a 1981 letter from Vort Exploration's attorney to Chevron. We would certainly hope that Gulf will readily agree that the contribution by Vort of the Callahan leases and the receiver's leases are worth an additional 15% of the working interest. The record is quite clear that Vort proposed to contribute its disputed leases from Callahan and the receiver for additional working interest. I ask the court to ponder why, in all of this correspondence, there's not a mention of the seismic. Why that letter doesn't say, we would hope that Gulf would agree that the contribution of the seismic and the leases is worth an additional 15%. Why there's not a single letter from Vort to Chevron saying, our seismic which we contributed is worth something. Why there wasn't ever a demand for payment of the seismic that was contributed. It just isn't in this record. Finally, I would ask the court, if in fact you conclude there is evidence and that quantum merit is an appropriate remedy, it should be confined to the cost of this seismic. There is good authority cited in our brief in this court and in the Court of Appeals, which was filed with this brief, for the proposition that when you render judgment in quantum merit, you look to the intent of the parties, that you glean the contract they were trying to reach. The four operating agreements, two proposed by each side, are absolutely the same in providing that the joint account will be charged with the cost of services provided by third parties or things provided by the operator. The agreements are identical. The joint account will be charged with the cost. And I think that is critical for this court to take that into account if, in fact, you determine that there was evidence of this to support the disputed fact finding. Finally, I would tell the court, Chevron presented to the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth a number of points of error that court did not address. Some are points of law, which this court can address. Some are insufficient evidence points, which the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth would need to address. So there are things that would need to be tended to by the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth should this court decide there is sufficient evidence to dispute to support the disputed fact finding. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the board.
Counsel, before you get started, I want to straighten out whether this question of whether the seismic was updated from 78 to 83 is in dispute or not. Your adversary says that it was not updated as far as the record shows. Is that correct?
No, sir. And in fact, the trial court in its findings of fact concluded that seismic was submitted in July of 1981 and prior thereto. And we disagree with opposing counsel's statement.
What finding is that?
Just a moment, Your Honor. Let me...
Well, that's all right. If it's a specific finding, I can find it. That's all right.
The number of it.
What does that finding say about updating?
It didn't make any specific statement about updating. It simply that seismic and geological data and so forth was furnished in July of 1981 and prior thereto. The statement of facts and all the exhibits show a number of seismic tests bearing different dates. And we disagree with the counsel's statement that it was not updated.
Was it? I know it was maybe furnished in 81, but was there anything new done, new logs made, new seismic work done between 79 and 81?
It was a testimony of Mr. Vandervoort that the work was updated and that new data was being provided to locate the exactly where it was in fact drilled. The last seismic plat of July 1981 showed a well location 700 feet from the north line and 400 feet from the east line. That was the exact spot that where the well was actually drilled. The prior locations were slightly different from that.
Has there been any drilling on any other locations prior to the drilling of the well in question?
Bort in the area immediately to the east had producing oil wells, and there was drilling there. There were offset wells. There was wells to the north and also wells to the south.
Were these done cooperation between Chevron? was this done in cooperation between Chevron and Gordon?
No, sir. This was all these other bore wells.
Wells were all bore. Was there any joint development other than the wells that you consider in question?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The only joint development or proposed joint development I know about is this well in question that's the basis of this lawsuit.
Well, ordinarily, there wouldn't be any reason to update the information because what's down there on the ground, unless it's got offset wells that have drained it, there wouldn't be any difference in 1979 and 1981. I don't understand why it was updated as to the disputed tract there.
I believe the examination of the board exhibits the seismic plats which appear in the statement of facts, a great number of them will show different dates and a slight variance in the exact well location.
Let me check.
What was the cost of drilling this well?
The estimate made by Chevron, which is attached as an exhibit to the brief filed in the Court of Appeals below, showed $300,000. That's the only evidence in the record that I know of in reference to the development process. Incidentally, the disputes about entering into an operating agreement focused on more than just the ownership or dispute over whether the receiver's leases were valid or not, or what about the Callahan leases. Also involved the dispute over who would be the operator and the initial authorization for expenditures, which in the opinion of Gore was too high. These were ongoing disputes, but it would seem to us, Your Honor, that the ultimate question, the ultimate issue in this whole thing is what was the benefit given by Bort to Chevron? The benefit was enormous. The next question, of course, is why was that given? On page 9 of the application for writ of error, Mr. Vandenbort recounts his testimony. Why were you giving Bort this seismic information? Well, in the spirit of cooperating with the agreement that we had. And he talked about we had an agreement, understanding we're going to work together to develop the leases. Then he says further that he anticipated, expected to jointly develop and jointly share the revenues and profits, and then the next question answered, would you have given that information, that confidential seismic data, log data? We're talking about logs from all the various wells that Bort had. Bort had a number of wells in that vicinity. He said, would you have done that but for your belief there was going to be some character of participation? He said, no, sir. Let me point out that Mr. Robert E. Griffin, the land manager for Chevron, testified in this trial in this court, Young County, Texas, but he did not mount the witness stand and say, Your Honor, that's wrong. We never had an agreement that we were going to work together. He never made that statement. The risk of loss factor mentioned here is another thing in reference to that operating agreement. We beg to differ with opposing counsel on the interpretation of that in reference to September of 83, because as we view it, the Bort leases had expired at that time by reason of non-payment of shut-in. Chevron knew that. Had Bort gone ahead and paid its 35%, Bort would have had nothing, and under that agreement, there's the printed form further provides that the party making that payment, even though the leases are lost, cannot recover back his drilling costs, even though the other party might still have 100% of the leases. So all these collateral issues about why didn't the parties get together and all that are beside what we seem to be saying is the main point, namely the right of recovery and quantum merit, the fact that, and as the trial court found, that to permit Bort to go unpaid, not recover anything, would be an act of unjust enrichment. And that's where we're coming from. The idea that you can recover only a cost, a third-party cost, is not consistent with the holdings of this court. It's true that there was out-of-pocket expense to third parties, but there was an ongoing effort on the part of Bort itself, which was an active operator in the area, and the question is what was the value of those services. That was what the court was concerned with in the Scott case, and in the Campbell case we had the same idea. What was the value of those services? On the Callahan leases, it was always the position of Bort that is an uncertain matter. I have plaintiff's exhibit number 92 to the attorney for Chevron, in which letters written by me to the attorney for Chevron, wherein I say, I certainly do not say that the Callahan heirs, in my opinion, have good and merchantable title to the minerals. So everything was up front, and even when the lawsuit started, there was still a continuing offer on the part of Bort to participate together to share in the Callahan leases. The, at the very outset, Bork made a proposal of a 50-50 sharing, but the thing was just never put together because of various and sundry reasons. And we don't think that the ultimate issue in this case is fault. Whose fault was it that they didn't get together with something? We don't feel that that is the ultimate issue and the case wasn't tried on that basis. We think the ultimate issue is the right of recovery under quantum merit. And we ask the relief from the adverse decision of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals.
Counsel, the opposing counsel says that the Austin case says that if you offer something to this joint venture with the expectation that if the well is drilled, you're going to get 35% of the royalty from the working interest, that you're not entitled to quantum merit.
Your Honor, I don't agree with that interpretation because the total value, as found by the trial court, this information was, as found by the court, was $275,000. And the trial court went on a 35-65 split and said the services were rendered for both Chevron and Bork. And Bork was permitted to recover only its own part of that, namely 65%, and it had to absorb the other 35. So in this finding here, the court found the services were rendered for both, and it apportioned the recovery.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess. Thank you.